Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Christian Sager.
If you've been listening to our podcast, you may have tuned into our episode on Egyptian mummification and the long history and evolution of mummification there, from a purely environmental mummification into this ultra-refined mortuary art.
Yeah, we went over the history of thousands of years of how mummification evolved. And during that episode, we said to you, the audience, hey, you know, there are lots of other forms of mummification out there. We're not going to be able to do them justice in this one episode. So do you want to hear more? And the answer seemed to be yes.
Yeah. Enough people said yes that we went ahead and did what we were going to do anyway.
Yeah.
Covered more mummies.
Yeah. Well, this one's too fascinating to pass up, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah. Because in this, we're getting into, there's still elements of environmental mummification and, funerary mummification,
mm-hmm.
but there's this added element of self-mummification.
So, and of course, when I started researching this, it immediately made me think of seppuku, which is another form of suicide in the same region, in Japan. And this is essentially suicide, in fact, so much so that it was banned by the Japanese government in the 19th century.
Yeah, I think we can't help but draw a line between these two forms of ultimately highly ritualized self-destruction.
Yeah, in fact, I would go so far as to say that this has some elements in common with Dr. Kevorkian, for instance. I mean, it's on a much longer term scale.
Yeah.
This takes like 10 years, I think, right, to self-mummify.
Yeah, it's definitely a deliberate act in which the individual is accepting death and really speeding it along to a certain degree and taking a certain amount of command over the process.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, enough teasing on our part here. What are we talking about here? This is the Soku Shinbutsu of Japan.
Yeah, this practice lasted from about 774 Common Era until the 20th century. And aside from 19 mummified members of the 12th century Fujiwara clan, it constitutes the only mummification rite in Japanese culture. One of our resources for this episode is an excellent piece by Ken Jeremiah titled Buried Alive, The Forgotten Practice of Self-Mummification. And he does a great job outlining this practice that was carried out by certain Shingon Buddhists who sought to serve Miroku Bosatsu, the Bodhisattva of the future, who will arrive on Earth some 5,670,000,000 years from now.
Yeah.
So this is essentially a Buddha that will arrive on Earth tremendous amount of time in the future.
And so from what I was reading, he is said to currently reside in what is called Tusita Heaven, which is this place that is depicted as flooded with rotating light. And this rotating light apparently reveals a 49-story palace. And it is a, you know, as most heavens are, a paradise with no sorrow or sin. The thing that's really interesting here about this particular group is the Sokushinbutsu practicing. It was in Yamagata, and there were members of a specific sect that brought together parts of esoteric Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, and some kind of local spiritual practices. So this is, I guess, like a version of mysticism, right? Like Buddhist mysticism, sort of.
Yeah. As we'll discuss, you see this, you know, like with any religion, religions don't travel unchanged. Any culture they enter, they end up absorbing pieces of pre-existing religions. They merge with cultural values, and so as Buddhism emerges from India, travels through China, into Japan, it ends up picking up all these different elements.
Sort of like how when we talked about the serpent and the rainbow in one episode, like the Voodoo culture incorporates aspects of local culture in Haiti as well as Catholicism into the mysticism and myth of zombies.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that makes any discussion of religious worldview fascinating, that ever-changing nature of it.
So these guys in particular thought that they could achieve special powers, obviously one of which was to live for 5 billion years and meet this Buddha in the future. But other things were they practiced meditating in caves or under these really cold waterfalls. And then some of them even stabbed out their own eyes and performed other forms of mutilation on themselves in order to gain these powers that were part of their beliefs.
Yeah, there's a huge trend here with a complete. I mean, they were aesthetics. They were rejecting the physical world, showing them in almost a contempt for the physical world in their devotion to the spiritual realm. And you know, there are definitely some kind of cool quasi sci-fi elements here too, because essentially they're wanting to put their body into a spiritual suspended animation so that they can reach this far distant time and place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you should explain that process because it's pretty wild. It reminds me of that Darren Aronofsky movie, The Fountain. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of that, this idea that, like, you're not even reincarnated, but, like, you will exist in this other state for this long, long period of time so that you can ultimately achieve transcendence.
Yeah, and I would not be surprised if he was inspired by some of these Eastern models.
Yeah.
So, in order to reach that 5.6 billion year point in the future and meet the Bodhisattva of the future and serve him, you have to self-mummify as a living Buddha, which Jeremiah explains as a means, again, to reach this Tuatsu Heaven, which is the current residence of the Bodhisattva of the future. So you have what you do is you engage in a slow and meditative approach to the death point. And it's only then that the monk can self-guide their soul through the void to a realm of his choosing. And this reminds me of elements of Tibetan Buddhism as well, where there's this huge emphasis on what happens immediately following death. And you've got to be prepared for that journey between this incarnation and the next.
And as we learned, there is a connection between Chinese and Tibetan Buddhism and this practice. They're culturally connected in a way, and we'll get to that later, but we wanted to start with these guys. And I say guys, they were all men.
Yeah.
The Sokushinbutsu practice.
Now, another source we're looking at is Mummification in the Ancient and New World. This is a wonderful resource for anything related to mummies. We'll include a link for this.
This is our go-to page every time we do something about mummies.
Yeah, from Anna Maria Rosso. And she classifies Shingon self-mummification as a case of entering a kind of undead suspension in which the monk's body is preserved for resurrection upon Mikoru Bosatsu's arrival. So they're kind of two different takes.
Yeah.
That are probably amounting to the same thing. Either you're sticking around until he comes, or you're preserving your body as kind of an anchor for your wandering spirit to go and serve him now.
Yeah, and so the first, I guess, founder of this that practiced this was Kobu Daishi, and he was alive from 774 to 835. And the idea here is that he remained in this particular state within the Gobyo Mausoleum. And monks to this day, right, still bring food to him as he awaits the arrival of their, you know, this Buddha in heaven, essentially.
Yeah, there's some wonderful images of monks bringing, it's a highly ritualized affair. It's not just someone pushing a cafeteria tray under a crypt door or anything. It's very ritualized, and they bring this fine chest up with food for him.
One of the things I read was that supposedly his nails and hair continued to grow for years after his death. And monks would go in there when they would feed him. They would also give him a trim and redress his body. And then, you know, they'd go back another 30 years later or whatever, and there'd just be dust. And the dust was the rags of the robes, essentially. And they'd clear it out and do the whole process all over again. But the myth is that his hair and nails kept growing, and so they had to cut it.
So in all of this, obviously we need to state that we're dealing with religious interpretations and often then supernatural layers all on top of a body's decomposition or lack of decomposition. So as we go through all of this, you know, keep an open mind about it, but also, you know, feel free to pick at it a little bit with your mind.
Yeah, and I think like the Egyptian mummies, there is, of course, the cultural and religious aspect that comes into play that, promotes this activity. But then there's a science behind it to actually achieve mummification in such a way that the body doesn't decay.
Right. Yeah, so what's the goal here? The goal is to gradually reduce one's physical body to a withered state. Just like, how much of a mummy can I become while still alive, while just meditating and trying to reach that death point, and then to remain dry and, for the most part, incorruptible. So in order to achieve this state, a would-be Sokushunbutsu first practices a starvation diet. Okay, and this consists of just nuts and berries and tree bark and roots. And this phase apparently would last between 3 and 10 years. However long it took to whittle that body down to a skin and bone state.
Yeah.
Atlas Obscura.
They're essentially starving themselves
to death.
Yeah. In fact, that diet, did you know, it was designed specifically to strip them of body fat. That's why they specifically ate those things. And in fact, some of the herbs and nuts that were involved in that diet were designed to, I mean, they didn't have the science of this, but they inhibited bacterial growth. So that was part of the process here of helping you mummify yourself.
Yeah, and I guess that could conceivably cut down on decomposition too, because so much of the decomposition, as we discussed in the previous mummification episode, is coming from within.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind as well. You're dealing with early people that are looking at a corpse's decomposition, they're often thinking of it as an externalized decomposition, the elements making the body decompose, when really it's most of the decomposition is occurring within as the body begins to fall apart, the bacteria feeds on everything.
Yeah, and as part of that, too, they weren't even allowed to eat specific things as part of their diet, too. So, like, cereal, wheat, rice, foxtail millet, proso millet, and soybeans were all things they had to stay away from because of, you know, it would promote bacterial growth.
Now, Atlas Obscura also has a page about self-mummification, and they mention that the poisonous sap from the Orushi tree was also used, that the monks consumed this to purge their bodily fluids and supposedly repel scavenging parasites.
Yeah, and this is brutal. The several accounts that I read of this, I mean, purge bodily fluids is accurate, but I mean, it was violent vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it, you know, for this reason. It was part of the sacrifice of being able to make this journey through time. And in fact, here's another interesting tidbit that I read. They did x-rays of some of these monks, and they found that there were river stones in their guts. So apparently they ate those too. I don't know what the promotion would be, like what, you know, how that would affect the mummification process, but they were filling their stomachs with stones.
Huh. And it goes without saying, if anyone out there is looking to lose weight, please don't try this diet. Yeah. Please don't try the self-mummification diet. though I could see that being the next big thing that kicks off. Okay, so you're finally reduced to the state of walking or maybe just sitting
down. Yeah, I wonder if they could even walk. I would imagine the other monks maybe had to help them get from place to place after a while.
Yeah, because they have to be pretty frail at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, you're buried alive, with a little help from your friends, obviously, for 3 years with only bamboo-breathing tubes to sustain you down there in the darkness. And here you meditate, you recite sutras, and you periodically ring a bell to let everyone know that you're still down there, still meditating, until eventually you're going to die from dehydration.
Yeah, so the idea here is that when they're buried alive, they're buried alive in the lotus position. So I think that the box or whatever they're in is designed to fit their bodies in the lotus position. And then when you stop ringing that bell, I think that you ring the bell once a day, basically to say, like, hey, I'm still moving down here. And when it stops, that's when they take the tube out and they seal the tomb. And there's a thing here, too, that the number three is very important to this ritual. They did things in threes, and it was particular to the Buddhist priesthood. The reason why is that apparently there's three jewels in Buddhism, the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dharma. And then there's the three great secrets, the secret of the body, which are mudras, which we know over here as, you know, yoga practice, basically. And then there's the secret of speech, mantras, and the secret of the mind, which is meditation. So that's why they wait for 3 years before they pull them back up.
And so when they do pull them up, the first thing you check is the corruption level of the body. If it's uncorrupted, then hey, success. Self-mummification has taken place. You dress the monk in robes and put them on display for veneration. If the body's rotted, however, you're going to perform an exorcism and bury the corpse.
Yeah, that two extremes. One is you're venerated forever. The other is this is a hideous, disgusting thing. We have to exorcise it. Like, you don't exorcise just a regular dead body.
Right.
But this process went wrong. And it, you know, within that practice, I can sort of understand how they would see it as being the opposite of holy.
Yeah, and as we'll discuss later, you see this interesting dichotomy here, where on one hand, there's still very much this idea that a corpse is a thing that is not, it's not pleasant, it's not to really be dealt with, you bury it and you get rid of it, except if it's the body of a very special individual, if the body itself is in this strange, undeath, uncorrupted state, and then it is an object of veneration.
Yeah, and I want to add here, they had a couple little cheats that they worked around here, too, after they pulled the bodies out. It's true that, you know, if the body itself hadn't decayed, that was when they venerated them. But after they pulled it out, if it hadn't decayed, they would preserve it by adding incense to the body, and then they would dry it out over a charcoal fire.
Yeah, and this kind of gets back to the original idea from our Egyptian mummies episode, where you have mummification begin as environmental process. And when the environmental process fails due to different environmental circumstances, such as more elaborate tombs that are being used, then you have to begin employing mummification techniques to fake what you're not achieving naturally.
Yeah.
And so we see a bit of that here. It's like, okay, if it has corrupted, or it looks like it's corrupting a little bit, what are some cheats we can apply to get it back into that, that desired zone?
Yeah, in the same way that the Egyptians started off by burying their bodies in the dry sands, and that would help to prevent them from decaying. They're in Japan just using charcoal fire and smoke basically to achieve the same thing.
Less than 30 Japanese monks are known to have completed this grueling journey to the death point. And, of course, we have no idea if they found the Bodhisattva of the future or if they're going to at some point in the distant future.
Yeah, I mean, that's still to come.
Yeah.
5 billion years, that's a ways off. But the Japanese government, like I said at the top, they did not like this. And as of the 19th century, it is illegal to do that. Though some of these monks did continue this practice and into the 20th century. I think like the early 1900s, there were monks doing this. The majority of which happened at a temple on Mount Yudono called Dainichibu. And there's an idea that there's a local spring there that has high levels of arsenic in it. So they think that has something to do as well with the mummification process, that somehow arsenic is contributing to this. And the area around there is where they conducted their exercises. And in Japanese, the area is called Senin-zawa, and that translates into the mountain stream of otherworldly men, or swamp of wizards, or swamp of immortals, which I like. I like both of those quite a bit.
The swamp of wizards.
Swamp of wizards.
Yeah. You can still visit 16 of these Soku Shinbutsus of the 28 that remain. There were 30 that were known to have completed it, but I think that some of them are off limits, you know, for obvious reasons. They're probably pretty fragile. But in various locations around Japan, you can visit these. Hundreds of people are thought to have attempted this. So that, you know, getting back to that, those exorcisms, there were hundreds of these exorcisms of these bodies that did decay.
Yeah, and also it's such a grueling endeavor to undertake. I can't imagine everyone who started out on this path had the fortitude to actually make it to that death point in the original prescribed way.
Yeah, I agree, and I want to add two stories about two of these monks that I think put it into a little bit of perspective here. And this isn't to say that all of the hundreds of monks that attempted this had these kinds of background, but the most famous of which that you can, I think, still visit is Daijuku Bosatsu Shinyokai Shonin. And he mummified himself at the age of 96 in 1783, and he's at that Mount Yudono Temple. He was a farmer, and the story goes that he was a farmer. He was walking along the road one day, and a samurai bumped into him, and the samurai took offense to this and started a fight, essentially. Drew his sword and started a fight. And this farmer only had a walking stick and somehow defeats the samurai and kills him in battle. But killing a samurai was illegal then, and the punishment was death. So he didn't want to die for defending himself on the road. So he fled to this temple and took up the religious, you know, practice and the name Shinyokai. So that's what led to his eventual, you know, immersion into this culture and then leading on to the self-mummification practice. But I got to say, like, if I got to 96, you know, I'd give it a shot.
Yeah, why not? I mean, you can only be in control of so many different things at that point. Why not be in control of your journey to the death point?
Yeah, and there's another monk known as Tetsu Munkai, who's another part of this order, and he supposedly killed two samurai with a fire hook.
What's a fire hook?
I don't know.
Oh, it's bringing such fantastic images.
I was just imagining it was a hook that's on fire, but I bet it's like a hook that you use to move charcoals around
that,
or something
like that.
That
would make sense. I bet it's that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we also see this traditional element of the common man does not have access to weapons and then create a martial art around common farming or crafting tools.
Well, this story was like a little too large for some people to believe, so they looked into it some more, and they think what actually happened is he killed a prostitute.
Oh, okay.
And then, like the other guy, fled to the monastery. Same thing. But this guy, remember how I was talking about how they would cut their own eyes out as part of practice? He's one of them. He cut out his own eye and threw it into a river because he wanted to pray for a cure for a local eye disease that was infecting the local villages.
Huh.
So that gives you kind of an idea of these practices. We don't have a lot of information on this, but it's pretty extreme.
Yeah, and I believe you were looking into this, and you found that there is a group that is advocating for more more access to the existing mummified monks.
There. Yeah, my understanding is that it's called the Japanese Mummy Research Group, and that apparently they're responsible for studying, you know, the mummified monks, and they petition the government for permission to exhume the graves of the ones that they find. But I believe that this was started around the same time that the practice was ending.
Okay.
So probably the beginning of the 20th century.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So now we're going to venture away from Japan and into China. And particularly, we're going to look at Chan Buddhism. This is a school of Mahayana Buddhism that developed in China from the 6th century CE onward. So here we see a definite merging of Buddhist and Taoist ideas. And it, interesting here is the notion that Buddhism and Taoist sorcery seem to combine into a notion of Buddha as a sort of foreign immortal who achieved some form of undeath.
Yeah, there's a fantastic piece that we used for this, well, as one of our sources for this episode, that's up on IO9 from a couple years ago, I think. And it's, you know what? I didn't realize it until I finished the piece and I rolled back up and I realized it's written by one of my favorite writers over there, a woman named Lauren Davis.
Oh yeah, she's good.
Yeah, it's some of my favorite stuff on their site is by her, but this is specifically about, in the Science and Civilization in China, a book which is the fifth volume of that series. And they speculate that the self-mummification originally was a Taoist practice. They note that while Japanese monks are the most famous self-mummifiers, there are deliberate self-mummifications that have also been recorded in China and India as well. So right. This is where, like, clearly there's a connection somehow between these two things. They couldn't have just, especially because they're from the same belief systems, they couldn't have just independently sprung up on their own.
Yeah, and so that's why we're looking at Chan Buddhism and some particular examples here among some of the Chan masters, because you see a form of mummification that maybe isn't quite as deliberate and self-destructive as the Japanese models we were looking at, but definitely a similar blueprint.
And the idea here is that this particular sect of Buddhism, which I was unfamiliar with until we researched this, is known for rejecting empty rituals and unworthy authority figures.
Yeah, there's a quote that I was reading in one of the great sources for this section of the podcast, Robert H. Scharf's The Idolization of Enlightenment on the Mummification of Chan Masters in Medieval China. He points out there's a quote that the Chan would use where it says, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. In other words, saying that if you meet somebody claiming to be this great individual, reject them. You
know? Yeah, I've heard that term before and I've always liked it, but I didn't realize that it originated here. And in fact, that this particular school, you know, the idea was they didn't want to be based around superstition, essentially. And so it's strange then that they were involved in the mummification thing.
Yeah, this is definitely a fascinating area where you see these merging and at times contradictory ideas coming from the Taoist roots and the Buddhist roots, where on one level Buddhism, you think of Buddhism and you think of, oh, it's all about not caring. It's about setting aside any high levels of anxiety about death or even life itself, that you're disconnecting. And then with Taoist sorcery, you have a far more supernatural understanding of man's place in the universe and what's possible with the physical body. And these two things kind of merge together into one form.
Yeah, and I'm sure, too, that, like, the political and economic and cultural pressures that were going on in the area at the time contributed to this melding, you know?
Yeah, the economic aspect will be interesting when we get into it.
Yeah, especially, one thing about this, you know, that's important to say, you hinted at it here, is that most Buddhism regards corpses as just lifeless lumps of flesh, right?
Yeah.
Rotting flesh in particular, and you just dispose of them. It's no longer a person. So again, it's a little strange, this veneration thing, but we'll get into, you know, there is a worship that was applied to their abbots in particular. And this explains their fascination with the possibility of bodies not decomposing. So they thought that if their bodies didn't decompose, that they were incorruptible. And this involved, you know, artificial mummification the same way that we've talked about previously. But it was thought as a mean to achieve spiritual purity and preserve it within the remains.
Yeah, so you see this idea that an individual is going to be holy enough, pure enough, that there's going to be residual purity, residual karma even in the body. And the Taoist roots here apparently are that a Taoist master sheds his body like the shell of a cicada, and then his spirit alone ascends into the spirit realm, leaving behind this incorruptible body. And the body serves as a kind of anchor for an immortal soul wandering beyond, which is a fabulous idea that is almost science fiction in its elements, like the idea of, say, a body in some suspended state. but the mind is wandering around in some sort of virtual reality.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, too, that these abbots, my impression from the reading was that these abbots were venerated because they were very charismatic, and the followers within their temples and their communities loved them dearly. And so part of this also was that the preservation allowed for the new abbot that would come in, who was maybe a little green and maybe not known so well, to have a little bit of leeway and time to get to know them better and build his reputation and charisma, while the mummified version of the previous abbot was still there for them to connect with.
Yeah, because the abbot and his charismatic power, it has a lot to do with the support from the community, the support from the government.
Yeah.
It's like having the lead singer of a band change out, right? But imagine if the new lead singer could say, actually, the old lead singer is right here. He's in this, he's not dead. He's in this undeath state. So he's technically still here. You can come and venerate him.
Yeah.
He's still the ritual and spiritual center of the monastery. And that's important too. It's not only the outside forces, but the inside forces. The abbot in this undeath state, in this mummified state, remains the rallying point for everyone.
Yeah. That's what Black Sabbath should have done, is they should have mummified Ozzy Osbourne and then had Ronnie James Dio, you know, perform with Ozzy's mummified body on stage. Or Van Halen could have done it as well. Sammy Hagar performs with the body of David Lee Roth.
They had the idea of an aged rocker as a mummy is just perfect. I mean, because they kind of reached that state on their own.
Exactly.
Look at any old rocker and you can easily see a mummification taking place.
Yeah, Mick Jagger is definitely approaching mummification. So the first Chan master mummy that we know of was a guy named Tao Sin, and he was alive from 580 to 651. When he passed away at the age of 72, his students wrapped him in lacquered cloth so that they could preserve the miracle of his natural incorruptibility. And so, like we were saying, this wasn't a normal practice for Buddhism. It was sometime in Eastern Han or early Sixth Dynasties period the rationale around this changed. They wanted to maintain the integrity of the body and the soul together after death through this kind of preservation.
Now, another example that Robert H. Scharf brings out in his piece is that of Shan Wu Wei, who died in 735 at age 99. But he wasn't buried until 740. And according to his biography, he was so, quote, imbued with meditation and wisdom that no decay occurred in the 5 years between death and the tomb. And in 758, 18 years later, his disciples dug him back up and then discovered very little decay, or so it's said. Again, you kind of have to throw in a little grain of salt here and there when it comes to the official religious account.
So what's the common practices here? So it's different from what we were talking about with the Japanese model earlier. It's not self-mummification in the sense that they starve themselves and eat nuts and berries and then bury themselves alive, right? It's not that gory. It's almost like the kind of mummification, in a lot of ways, similar to Egyptian mummification.
Yeah, because you do see these varying levels of embalming techniques coming online to make up for missing environmental factors. Mummification itself in China goes back as far as 206 BCE. And the notion of a lingering soul presence in the body may underlie all of it. It seems to underlie any mummification practice.
Yeah, and the spirits of your ancestors still to this day seems to be fairly potent cultural idea in China.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
So they had various preservation practices. One is just temporary burial, which, again, has a lot in common with the Egyptian model. Bury them in the ground, right. And if the ground is dry, then it's going to dry the body out.
Okay.
Drying over a fire, which you mentioned already,
oh, yeah,
is another
charcoal,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is my favorite, though. Salt brine used inside of an urn to pickle the body, essentially pickle the body.
Yeah, I read about that one. That is, so you put the body in there and let it soak for like years,
yeah.
Right? And then you take it out and mummify it.
Ooh. Yeah. And in any of these cases, when you get the body back out, it's dried out, you wrap it in various layers, including lacquered cloth, then you dress it in robes, and you place it in a position befitting a Chan master.
So from what I was reading, the lacquering process is actually very similar to the same process that they used to produce specific kinds of Buddhist sculptures, and it resulted in a durable finished product. So I think that that's where they got the idea from. They said, well, let's apply this statue process to, you know, venerating our elders. And so do you want to get into the thing about that there's a technique of placing jade and bone in the 9 orifices of the body?
Yeah, this is interesting. And I don't have a lot of details on this. I probably don't have to employ them. But the use of jade is interesting. Because it was a common Han Dynasty method for the wealthy to be buried in a suit of jade.
Yeah.
People may have seen images of this. It's not a solid suit of jade, but it has like jade jade squares,
you know,
jade tiles. And this is because the stone was thought to prevent decay. So if it works on the outside, which there's no evidence that it did,
right.
But if it worked on the outside, then the magical thinking is that it would work inside as well.
Uh-huh.
Because as with the Egyptian model of mummification, you see this continuing struggle to try and figure out where decay is coming from the outside or from the inside. Therefore, put the jade on the outside and put it on the inside. If you ever have the opportunity to see a Chinese mummy, definitely take advantage of it. I got to see one at the Museum of the Western Han Dynasty Mausoleum Guangzhou when I was there a couple of years ago to get my son. He was not impressed. He was a year and a half and did not see the beauty of everything there and cried his head off, but did get to see a fabulous restored mummy there with the jade suit, and that would have Zhao Mei, the second ruler of the kingdom of southern Yu.
Now, I think I've brought up on the show before that I spent some time in my childhood in Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. and I lived in China for 6 or 7 weeks on my own, actually, when I was a teenager, which is kind of a wild story. But I never got to see anything like that. That sounds really cool.
Well, apparently there are only a handful of these. I think there are more than 10.
Okay.
So that's about how many have been recovered. Only 5 have been restored. So,
okay.
So I just kind of lucked into getting to see one while in Guangzhou.
So another thing about these specific Chan Buddhist monks, the way that they were preserved, after they were covered in the lacquered cloth, they were gilded as well.
Oh, yes.
So there's elements of gold here, right? Or some kind of metal. And they're dressed in fine robes afterwards as well. So when you saw that one, did it have that kind of shiny exterior?
I don't remember there being as much of a shiny exterior so much. But the jade suit was the thing that made the big impact on it.
Yeah, and given how old they are, too, I would mm-hmm. imagine over time that, you know, that would kind of fade.
Yeah.
So one of the things about this is that there is a traditional funeral practice even before this mummification came into effect, in which the abbots were always buried with a portrait of themselves nearby. And at some point, mummifying the abbot replaced the portrait. The idea of being able to interact with the abbot and his spirit. So it created a flesh icon. Which I love that.
That's the term that Schraff uses in his piece, flesh icon.
So they could use these as both an effigy and a holy relic. But there's also, as we talked about a little bit earlier, is that there's the aspect of interacting with the government here, too, and the economy. So a lot of these temples and institutions were supported by government funds. And so if the abbot was very popular with the community and very charismatic and then passed away, there's always the possibility that the government might withdraw funding and think, oh, well, this is no longer an active institution, right?
Yeah, it comes back to the lead singer scenario
we're talking
about. The lead singer drops out, then how are you going to keep the support for your product going?
So they mummified them in order to keep it active. And again, like we were talking about, the new singer, the new abbot comes in and kind of gets used to the community then and hopefully builds up enough of a following that he too gets mummified.
You know, I do want to throw in real quick that another fascinating aspect of this that came out in my research is that according to Holmes H. Welch, he's an early 20th century expert on East Asian culture, particularly Taoism and Buddhism, and he's talking about the mummification of the bodies. And he points out, of course, how they were gilded. But, quote, sometimes the lobes of the ears were lengthened and a dot was placed between the eyebrows. Golden skin, long lobes, and the Uma dot were among the 32 sacred marks of a Buddha. The implication was, therefore, that in his lifetime, the monk whose corpse the visitors saw before him had attained Buddhahood. So in this, we see post-mortem body modification, which granted, any form of mummification or funerary rite, you know, anything a mortician does is body modification. But generally, we're all about, let's just make it look as much like it did when it was alive. But here we see a modification to make the body look more like the spiritual ideal as opposed to just what they were.
Definitely. From what I've seen, the photographs during the research, I mean, these do not retain human form in the way that, say, like our typical idea of an Egyptian mummy does, right?
Right.
Because it's not stuffed full of lacquered linen and all kinds of materials. But it is you know, designed to be an icon in the same way like a statue would be.
And really to be kind of a transhuman body for mm-hmm. a different type of being, which is such a fascinating idea. Yeah. And I think there are elements of that in Egyptian mummification as well, but I think it's often lost on us. And I feel like this example brings out that motif in a new way.
Yeah. Every time we get into this kind of stuff, I have to think to myself, like, what kind of post-death rituals are we going to come up with in the future? You know, like, where are we going yeah. with that? Will we start taking our bodies and, you know, with transhumanism coming along, you know, will we start trying to make them look more alien or something like that?
Yeah, we ended up, me and Joe did a podcast episode on the near future of various funeral rites.
Yeah.
We didn't get into this as much, but I can't help but think of RoboCop, remember? Because there's a whole scene where it's like RoboCop meeting his former wife.
Oh, yeah.
And someone's pointing out, well, this isn't him. We did this to honor him.
Yeah.
Which if you take
right,
that
the
approach,
face is just like glued on over like a robot.
Yeah. So in a sense, he's buried within RoboCop. He's kind of like a Warhammer 40,000 dreadnought where the tomb is the robot. Which, so in a way, RoboCop is a funeral rite.
Yeah.
And one that I think we should all be open to.
Yeah. Why not? Right? It in the movies, it went really well.
It did. Yeah. It went great. All right. So we've discussed the Soko Shimbitsu. We've talked about the Chan masters. And those are just two specific examples from East Asian mummification history. And we can't get into all of the examples in this podcast. Maybe we'll come back for more later. You do see related examples, particularly in Thailand. Mm-hmm. Very much the same model, I think, as Chan Buddhism, but certainly an area that deserves its own spotlight, perhaps at a later date.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, there's, of course, other mummies, too, especially in the American continent. So there's possibility that we could talk about Mayan or Chinchuru mummies in the future, too. So if you're interested, let us know.
Yeah, sounds good to me. I am certainly down to do more episodes on global mummification rituals.
Me, too. So let us know. There's tons of avenues to get in touch with us. In fact, we are on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. On all of those social media platforms, we are under the handle Blow the Mind. That's where you can find us and interact with us. But not only that, we're on Periscope every Friday at noon now, and you can directly interact with us there. If you haven't used Periscope before, you get to see us hanging out in front of an iPad and chatting with you. Conversations that we had last week were about the possibility of you, Joe, and I writing our own horror anthology book. One of our fans suggested that.
All right. We'll keep suggesting that.
Yeah. And of course, you can always visit the site, stufftoblowyourmind.com, where we've got blog posts and videos and all kinds of other content that's not just the podcast. We work hard on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, and we've got all kinds of crazy things out there, especially about mummies, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we have a lot of content about mummies. And I'll make sure to include some links to it in the landing page for this episode, as well as links out to some of these key resources if you want a deeper dive into the topics. And hey, if you want to reach out to us directly, you don't have to self-mummify yourself. You don't have to slowly poison yourself in a Buddhist crypt.
Yeah, we're here.
Instead, just send us an email. You can reach us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.